Okay, we're now on take two, side two.
I'm afraid I wander quite a bit.
No, that's great.
Well, the Vietnam years were quite interesting. The American colony there mixed with the other international types, and we were an American colony, no question about it. We didn't live all clustered. I had a house in back of the ambassador's house, and next door to me there was an intelligence guy who worked directly for the ambassador. But I was afraid in that house because I was way off from the other Michigan Staters. Ralph's house was kitty corner from the palace, mm-hmm. the back side of the palace, on Hong Top Tu Street. And I was Hien Vong Street. And it was a nice house. It was a big house. Two rooms, air-conditioned. And we did have, I think, four servants. We had a cook. We had an ama for little Johnny, the young one. He was only 9 months old by the time we got there. And the other two kids didn't need an ama, and we... They played around the house mostly and with other kids, Paul's kids especially. Paul had two boys and two girls, and they were just a little older, but not much. And so the kids got together with the others, and they would have parties, and we got into a bigger international group there too. The Danish guy who sold Volkswagens there, who everyone thought was a spy. Well, we thought everyone was a spy, really. I never saw anything like it. but they warned us, to begin at the Foreign Service Institute, assume that every one of your household servants will be reporting to somebody, either the police or the Viet Cong or to the Germans or Russians or to the International Control Commission, someone. Because there's a lot of money floating around for information on what you're doing and vulnerability. And about a week after I got there, a CIA agent came into my office and handed me a piece of paper and said, "We just translated this from Radio Hanoi." And I can still remember the wording of it. It said, "We welcome Victor Strecker and his wife Barbara and their three sons, Victor Age, Michael Age, Jonathan Age. They are living at 232 Hien Vuong in Saigon. Anybody who finds it possible to execute Strecker will be considered a Vietnamese patriot. Address everything, you know. Talk about intimidation." Mm-hmm. I think I lost that in one of my moves because I've moved so many times since then, but I had this, it was a flimsy, and mm-hmm. I've written it down. I've put that in my personal recall files. But that came about a week after I got there, and I thought, ooh, they're inside everything. And the ages really impressed me, because they were correct. There was another sentence in the middle. Strecker is joining the infamous MSU group, whose work includes the burning of villages, the torture of citizens, and the training of the brutal South Vietnamese Xiam's police. And so they were referring to the civil guard, which was out there a lot. Mm-hmm. And it was that scared me very much. Every time I left town, I worried that they might victimize Barbara or the kids. And when I'd leave, whoever was staying there, one of the guys like Hanville, or if Paul didn't go, Paul and I traveled a lot together. But when he didn't go, I'd ask him to stop in every day and see Barb. And they did a lot of that. And
did other faculty get similar notification?
About going there?
No, from the Viet Cong.
Oh, you know, I never asked. I showed it to Ralph and I said, what about this? And he said, yeah, they do that. He said, no one's been hurt. And so I never showed it to Barbara.
Probably a good idea. You've been on the next boat home.
I never showed it to her. Even when we went to Milwaukee to see our relatives before we flew over, her dad had clipped an article from a news magazine that said, Saigon, the sin capital of the world. And I thought, oh, geez, you're taking my daughter to the sin capital, or of the Far East, I guess it said. And it was a lurid kind of a story, but it wasn't as bad as Macau or some of those other places, really. And Ziem was a Puritan, so he was really beating down on that stuff. I have an opium pipe and other things that they confiscated, and, you know. But the intimidation was all they could make it. The Viet Cong did try to scare you, and the South Vietnamese government tried to scare everyone. They had lurid tales. I have a few of them I brought back with me, and daily news bulletins about people beheaded and tortured and this and that in the villages, and the land development centers where they were trying to put a lot of people so that it would be harder for the Viet Cong to operate out there. And I sent my family home early. I was criticized for it, but I just didn't like it. When we got there, we could drive anywhere, and we did. The first Christmas, Barbara and I drove up to a town called Dalat in the mountains, mm-hmm. and there were French villages, French chateaus up there from the French colonial days. And one of them was owned by or rented by the U.S. government for employees of mm-hmm. USAM and the other outfits. And so we got it for a week, but you would get one wing, and they were so big that there would be two or three other families there. And it was nice and cool up there, the first cool weather we'd had since we got there in July. And it rained, thunderstorms in the mountains were nice. And we drove back in the Volkswagen, and we had taken Tihai with us to take care of John while we were up there, because she was indispensable to give Barb a little freedom. And Tihai was sitting in the back seat, and Tihai on her paper showed that she was born syphilitic. And her face was pockmarked and so forth, and she was a little bit homely, and we loved her. And we drove up there, and on our way back, we saw a Montagnard family, and these were Jirais, and they're wearing the baskets on the back, and this fine woven cloth with patterns on it, and the man has a pipe in his mouth, and he has the inevitable bow and arrow, and his wife has a coop coop, which is a chopping thing. And they have two children. And we drive past them, and they watch us. And I slowed down a little so we could see them clearly. And Tihai in the back seat holds her noise and says, "Ooh." And I said, "What's that, Tihai?" And she said, "Moise." Now that's like the N-word. Montagnard is the real title, but Moi is the N-word. And the Vietnamese called those people Moise. And she held her nose, this homely little girl without any prospect in the world, looking at a magnificent little family group along the roadside.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, everyone needs their underclass. It was such an interesting thing for her to say that. Fui, dirty.
Mm-hmm.
Dirty people. One day I was lecturing on records administration to a high command school in Saigon. And it was a big room, and it had maybe 50 people in it, all captains and higher, some very high ranking. And I had an interpreter. And so I'd give a sentence, he'd interpret, and I'd draw pictures of the things that interact. I was teaching Ralph's course, you know. And so I finished the course and asked if there were any questions, and they would get up and stand next to their seat and give their name and then ask a question in Vietnamese, and the interpreter said, Colonel Bai wants to know, what about Little Rock? And I've written this up too, by the way, in my recall. What about Little Rock? And I said, I'm not sure I understand. So he translated that, and he said, he wants to know why you have to use military to get colored people into the high school in Little Rock, while your president has to send troops. And I thought about that. I said, well, there are people who have prejudice against black people in America, and other people unlike themselves too, and not just black. Sometimes it's religion. He translated that. He said, but why can this happen in America? I said, well, I said to the interpreter, ask Colonel Bai how many Montagnards are in the room. And this could have got me in trouble, I thought since. How many Montagnards are in the room? And the interpreter looked at me and I said, I can't ask him that. I said, ask him. He said, I can't. So we had a little argument, and finally he did ask him. And this guy stiffens, and everyone in the room, you know, the eyes are going around. And finally the guy, he kind of sputters, he said, of course there are none, translated. And I said, why not? There are a lot of Montagnards in Vietnam. And the answer came back fast. He said, because they're ignorant, they're stupid, they're dirty, they can't learn, they can't read or write, they live like animals. And I said, in reply, I said, tell Colonel Bai that that's what some white people in America say about black people. And I don't know what I started there, but I was sort of pissed off at this guy, because they're so biased toward the native people there. And so that course ended in disarray. I don't know if anyone ever complained formally, but they were not happy with me.
Nobody likes to have showing the hypocrisy.
Everybody has an underclass, has someone they consider inferior to them, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the experiences that I sort of cherish, because it brought it home so forcibly. And Ralph is one of the people in the world who has none of that in him.
Mm-hmm.
He just doesn't.
No.
And he taught me that. I hope I learned it from him. But because I came from a family that was from Eastern Europe, and they hung together, and you know, they had the pejorative term for every other ethnicity there was. No one was Polish, you know what they were. No one was Jewish. It was, and I grew up in that setting. And ethnicity is very big in Milwaukee. It comes from being a big immigrant city. And a lot of them are natural enemies. So Ralph grew way beyond all that somehow, having come from the same place. And I think he taught me a lot about people are people. And he, I have a note, foreign students. He was the guy, when we got a foreign student, he was the guy who took care of him. You know, the others, we got a, the first Korean was Myung Chung Sok, got a master's degree from us. And I was on his thesis committee. And several of the other faculty wanted nothing to do with him. And, you know, they didn't like Korea anyway, and it was a little chilly. But Ralph would have him out to the house, and he helped every one of them. And at one point I heard, and you know better than I probably whether this is so, that Ralph actually trained a forensic scientist for almost 60 or even more different countries. I don't know if this is true.
It's certainly something close to that.
It's a number up there.
Yeah.
And I knew this. I knew that he could go into any country that we would ever think about going to and visit someone in a crime lab whom he had trained.
Mm-hmm.
And get taken around and shown things. He was inside every country, Thailand, Indonesia, Singapore, Japan, Taiwan, parts of Africa, parts of South America. Just an astonishing array. Philippines, he trained a guy for Philippines, several. That part of him, you get invited to Ralph's house, we'd have foreign students there.
Oh, yeah.
And he made sure they met the faculty and in a social setting, because there was no other real setting. Art didn't do much of that.
Mm-hmm.
Art was a, you know, he, I think at some point, up to about 55, he was overworked running the campus police and the,
right.
and the school. And the police training program, which was pretty extensive. That was a big operation. Always had three or four staff there, sometimes maybe five. That's how Jack Ryan and the FBI guys got in there, the police training. And so Ralph simply took on the social function and became our bridge to international students. And he'd put him in touch with other people who spoke their language. He knew the people in languages, and he would learn a little of all the languages that he needed when he was traveling, but he would get mixed up sometimes and talk French in a Chinese restaurant or something, you know. Barbara once was with him in England when he was asking for the bill in French in a place where Chinese was spoken. It was pretty funny.
It sounds like Ralph.
Oh,
it does.
He was quite something.
When did you come back from Vietnam? You said you sent your family back first.
Yes.
Was this after the coup, or what was the reason?
It was after the coup and
coup attempt, I guess we should say.
In 60, that was November of 60. Just a few weeks before that. And this is another Ralph story, and I've written it. One of our members, who was a contract worker with our mission, was down at the basic police training school at Vung Tau, Cap St. Jacques. And he got in his Jeep one morning to go, he was a firearms instructor, got in his Jeep with his driver, and they're driving along, and an ox cart pulls across, and shooters on both sides down in the ditch shot him with, we counted like 6 different calibers. But anyway, shot him all up, set the Jeep on fire from its gas tank. So there was some burning and so forth and so on. So Ralph says, I want your help on something. Paul and I both did one thing, and then I went with Ralph on the other. And it was the autopsy. Because if there's a violent death, it has to be investigated. You have to have a pretty much a full autopsy sent to the ambassador, who sends it to the State Department. Mm-hmm. And so we kept him in the commissary freezer until we could get to him, and which was a couple days later. And we had him brought into this Seventh-day Adventist hospital that had a little wing on it where we could have him brought in. And they put him on a table, and we had a French surgeon do the cutting. And so Ralph and I and Paul did the autopsy on one of our colleagues, and his name was Adolf. And he'd been a military type, military police, hired on. And so we did this autopsy. We dug these bullets out. The doctor would, he'd say, qu'est-ce que c'est? And Ralph would say, and he'd probe and get the slug and bring it out and put it, and Ralph would mark it the way he, mm-hmm. on the base of the bullet, put it in a glassine envelope and say where it came from on the body. Photographed everything, did all this. And I remember when we were done with it, we had 8 or 10 slugs out of him. He really got shot up. And Ralph said, okay, take his ankles, Vic. And he and Paul took his upper side, and we were going to put him back on the gurney, and the skin started coming off his ankles because he'd been dead a couple of days. And it started turning under me, and I thought, now I know this is ugly, but that happened in October. And then in November, we get the attempted coup, and that was a very close thing. Mm-hmm. If it hadn't been for the Muang troops that he brought down with a promise for a very, very big pay, he brought them down from the border with China very quickly, and one general remained loyal to him, brought him up from Vung Tau, and brought this other group in, and their orders were, seem to join the rebels, and in the morning at 6 o'clock, kill the rebel next to you. And that was the third day. And on the third day, each one of the Hmongs turned to the guy next to him and popped him. And they killed an awful lot of rebels and took it back. Because at that time, the rebels had Saigon. And Ziem was holed up in his palace, which was all full of holes. So that's how we put it down. But that, the basic insecurity of it, the contentiousness of the regime, and then one day, some guy flipped a grenade over a wall. One of our guys who was in the tax thing for MSUG, he got out of his car to go to lunch at home, and he always got a 2-hour siesta period. And he closed the gate and started walking for the house, and he heard something clink on the gravel. And he looked, and it was a grenade, and it blinded him. And I looked at that, and I thought, So they were cautioning us, don't send your families home, we need a show of support here. Well, At that time, I was just plain afraid because I was going to do a lot of traveling. And Jerry Hemme and I, our radio engineer with MSU, we went up to Ban Matuit to find a location for a new Civil Guard tower, radio tower. Mm-hmm. And he was doing tests there. And we went tiger hunting, incidentally, but that was after I sent my family home. And they went to Milwaukee and stayed with my folks. And then Barbara flew over and met me in Geneva. And we spent a couple of weeks traveling in Europe and then went home. So, but that, there were a lot
of... How long were you there by yourself then?
About 4 months, four and a half. Sent them home in late January, and I left in May. I left the week that Lyndon Johnson came. he was there at the time I flew out, and I have pictures of all the little Vietnamese kids holding American flags along the route in from the airport and all that, signs, 1,000 years for Lyndon Johnson, you know. Mm-hmm. It was... And of course, we'd been asking for either reinforcements or get out of there. We were asking for mules and all sorts of things to help the Civil Guard out there. They were, I'll tell you, apocalyptic story. One of the guys comes back with his group that had traveled in the U.S. and comes back, and I always debriefed him. And he was a Vietnamese lieutenant. And he had criticized the Vietnamese government at some place in the U.S., I forget now. Big City PD sitting, several other guys there with him. They heard him say, well, there's a lot of brutality or this or that. And there was. So anyway, they informed on him. And he came to me, and he was terror-stricken. He said, you've got to save me. I said, from what? He said, they're going to put me on the Cambodian border. And I said, well, is it a post? He said, they're sending me there with one elephant and a Moy guard to get me there, and I'm going to be by myself with a little radio. And I said, I don't know if I can do anything. He said, they'll kill me there. I said, who? The Viet Cong. He said, I have no chance there. I talked to Ralph about it, and he said, we can't do a thing. Can't do a thing. He talked to General La, who was the head of police and security, but this guy went to the border, and we never heard from him again. So don't speak ill of the Vietnamese government. You give it an elephant and a radio.
Good luck.
Yes.
Maybe it's time to change sides.
Oh, it was about that time that they kidnapped some Americans and kept them hostages for... They were in a different group. They were in USAM, but they kept them for 3 or 4 years. Some died in captivity of illnesses, mostly. They just took them along with them, chained up, you know, tied with bamboo threads and stuff. And it was, it got to be a dangerous place. A year after we could drive anywhere, you couldn't leave Saigon. Jerry Hemme and I went up to Ban Matuit on a Vietnamese Air Force plane, which was almost as dangerous. Mm-hmm. But we drove around in jeeps. When I first got there, and we did this great big tour of of Vietnam, Charlie Sloan and Ryan and I. Jack was just a hell of a guy. I don't know if you've...
I've heard about it.
Well, his mother was a French Army nurse. His father was the chief of police of Minneapolis and then the sheriff of Hennepin County later in Minnesota. And Jack came out of the FBI. But during World War II, he was a B-24 or 5 pilot, I forget which. Shot down, parachutes in, fluent in French from his mother's side, joins the Maquis. They get him out to Marseille and to Britain. They put him right back on another bomber. He gets shot down a second time. This really did happen. And he gets out again the same way. And by then I think the war was almost over. But, you know, that was the kind of background. He was tough, but he was smart. He joined the FBI as soon as he got out of the Air Force, or the Army Air Force, I guess. No, the Air Force. Anyway, joined the FBI, got a lot of the spy stuff because of his language.